You're listening to FBC Perspective, a podcast from First Baptist Church, Kelowna.
Hello from First Baptist Church in Kelowna. This is Pastor Kevin Green. I'm your host. And I'd like to welcome you to our Perspective podcast, where we talk about things that help us live better lives. And today we're going to be talking about Orange Shirt Day and what it means for us to be part of the healing that needs to happen in our nation and in our cities with our Indigenous brothers and sisters all across the country and maybe right next to you. I'm really pleased to have Jody Sparger with us today as our host and guide through this discussion. Jody is a catalyzer at Healing at the Wounding Place. And Jody, welcome to the podcast. It's good to have you.
Thanks. Good to be here, Kevin.
Jody, my first question on hearing your title is, what is a catalyzer and what is healing at the wounding place?
Sure. So I like I like the title of catalyzer because I'm not a director, I'm not a CEO, I'm none of those things, but I do hope that in a whole bunch of different settings where there's need for healing and justice, that I might be able to play some small part in bringing pieces together that might set off a reaction for deeper healing and justice. And then you asked what's healing at the wounding place, which is a mouthful of a title of an organization. But the idea of healing at the wounding place is that I work with churches primarily towards healing and justice with Indigenous peoples. And the church has been a site of wounding in much of our history. Mm. And acknowledging that that has been our place in the story is an important starting point for any dialogue around healing and justice. But that healing and justice are outcomes that we hope for and long for, but that in order for those to come, we really have to press in to finding where those sites of wounding are to staunch the bleeding, because if you can't stop the bleeding, then no matter how many pretty band-aids you put on, the patient will eventually die out, bleed out.
So that title really makes sense to me now that you explain it. And I wonder for Indigenous people, if they kind of get it right away.
I explain this title a lot to settler folks, and I've never once explained it to an Indigenous person. So yeah,
they get it. And can you tell us what Orange Shirt Day is? Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, so Orange Shirt Day is September 30th. And even though people can't see it, I am wearing my orange shirt today. And it's a day set aside to remember the legacy of residential schools, but also to remember the resilience of Indigenous peoples themselves. And placing it in September is a good signal to us all that that school, back to school, is part of a healing journey, according to Pam Palmateer, for Indigenous peoples, because school, just like churches, has been a site of wounding for so long that that even heading back to school is full of all kinds of trauma triggers for many generations of Indigenous people. If you don't mind, Kevin, can I just read? I think it's best to hear the story of Orange Shirt Day in the voice of the person who started it. Do you mind if I just read her story?
Love to hear it
in her own words.
Yeah, love to hear that.
So Phyllis Webstadt is the woman who started Orange Shirt Day, and this is what she has to say about it. She says, I went to the mission for one school year, 1973 to 1974. So depending on the age of your listeners, you can figure out how old you were or were not at that stage. That's when I was born. She had just turned 6 years old. I'll go back to Phyllis's voice here. She said, I lived with my grandmother on the Dog Creek Reserve, and we never had very much money, but somehow my granny managed to buy me a new outfit to go to the mission school. And I remember going to Robinson's store and picking out a shiny orange shirt. It had string laced up in front and was so bright and exciting, just like I felt to be going to school. But when I got to the mission, they stripped me and took away all my clothes, including my new orange shirt. I never wore it again. Mm-hmm. I didn't understand why they wouldn't give it back to me. It was mine. The color orange has always reminded me of that and how my feelings didn't matter, how no one cared, and how I felt like I was worth nothing. All of us little children were crying and no one cared.
So actually, Jody, I'm kind of in some ways relieved that this is just audio, because that actually teared me up a bit. And I just wonder if you can talk about the emotional impact of that on Orange Shirt Day. And if we do participate in Orange Shirt Day, what are we saying to our neighbors and friends and to Indigenous people in Canada?
Yeah. So it's an easy way to stand with Indigenous people around the slogan of Orange Shirt Day, which is Every Child Matters. Mm. And it's an acknowledgement that that the legacy of residential schools in Canada is harmful and continues to have impacts to this day. Mm-hmm. And it's also a way of saying that those impacts continue even in systems that continue to be unequal for Indigenous students as well. And if I can come back to that comment about schooling being a healing, part of a healing process. Pam Palminteri is a Mi'kmaq lawyer and activist and writer. And it really struck me when I heard her say that, because she talked about how for many cultures, education is a way that we improve ourselves. We get, generation after generation, more and more opportunity gets opened up as access to education gets opened up. But that for Indigenous people, that they can't even begin that process because it's been such a wounding experience. And so that it has to be a site of healing before it can be a site of improvement and transformation. So those are important things for us to just acknowledge and say out loud. But also the orange is fun, right? Like, it's a bright color. And there's something about wearing orange and seeing others in orange that speaks again to Phyllis's and others' resilience, that they are still here, they are still showing up, that Indigenous people are overcomers and long for this thriving of all children in our school systems.
So our listeners can't see this, but you're wearing like a particular orange shirt. Will any orange shirt do on this day?
Any orange shirt will do on this day, yes. Okay. But there have been some really fun contests that happen in different regions around students submitting designs for Orange Shirt Day. Who knows? It could even be a good pandemic exercise for folks in your church to design your own orange shirts.
And where are they available?
It depends on... Depends on lots of things. You probably have a friendship center in your town, and they often sell orange shirts. Okay. And some of you will have kids in school systems where there are connections with purchasing orange shirts in bulk sometimes.
So Jody, I wonder if you could tell us a bit about residential schools, because I think we hear that term and don't really quite understand the impact that they've had, because we just have this idea of what school is, but this is something very particular. Can you tell us about residential schools?
Yeah, so residential schools in Canada are that legacy of the government mandating that Indigenous children needed to be removed from their homes, from their cultures, from their lands, and from their families, and from their language. In the early policies set by Duncan Scott Campbell, the policy was that if you could remove the Indian from the child, that you could absorb Indigenous people, Indians as they called them at the time, Indians into the body politic, and that then we would have no more Indians and no more Indian problem. So this was the government mandate. And then churches ran those schools. But they were very different, as you said, from the schools that most of us grew up in.
So the word problem came up a lot. Like, why did they see, quote, Indians as a problem?
Because land acquisition was the primary objective of government at the time, and the biggest barrier to that acquisition of land were Indigenous peoples who were living on the land that we would want, that we wanted to call empty and void, but was in fact inhabited.
So they were in the way.
They were in the way.
Mm. So how long were these schools running for?
So 150 years is how long residential schools ran in Canada. And the last one closed in 1996.
1996.
1996 was the last one. So they weren't government mandated through 96, but they did continue to operate through that time.
That's actually kind of mind-boggling that 96 wasn't that long ago.
It was not.
So they were trying to remove the, to kill the Indian and the child. That was the objective. And what sort of actions did they take to make sure that would happen?
Yeah. So some of those that I named, the banning of Indigenous languages being used in the schools, with really severe, crazy punishments for that, including things like putting a needle through the tongue of a child and leaving it there for days. So I heard the story of an Indigenous woman who had that experience in residential school and longed to be able to teach her children and grandchildren her language, and she remembered it, but she had physical piercing pain every time she recalled her language, her mother tongue.
Yeah, it was just connected, that pain to the memory. Wow.
So removing language, removing kids from their homes and from their families was a deliberate action. And the schools were not, by and large, primarily set up for education. Most of them were set up to do more of job training. And so the kids might have labored for 8 hours of the day and had educational instruction for 2 hours of the day. 150 years is a long period of time to be able to describe exactly what all residential schools looked like, but by and large, they were not set up to educate children.
So what kind of impact has the residential school system had on Indigenous communities?
Yeah, so as we've talked about, there's been this ongoing, what we call intergenerational impact. And there are two aspects of that that are worth noting. So one is you have generations and generations of people who were not parented. Mm-hmm. And so the undermining of those structures of nurture and care and support continues to have ongoing impact. But also there's some interesting work happening in epigenetics around impacts of trauma. And so if you subject mice are helpful for these kinds of studies because they procreate very rapidly. And so you can look at many generations in a short period of time. But if you subject mice to an electric shock that corresponds with a bell, for seven generations, those mice will respond to the sound of the bell as though it were a shock, even though the first generation was the only one to be exposed to this shock.
Wow.
So that explains a lot about, again, the impacts of the kinds of traumas that happened through residential schools and the reasons why that continues to impact students who didn't go to the schools, but who have intergenerational impacts.
So Jody, after all of this, I hope and I think some of us are becoming more and more aware of how wrong and disgusting and terrible the whole thing was. So we have this national initiative called the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Can you tell us what that is and what they're trying to accomplish?
Yeah, so the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was the product of a class action lawsuit, the largest class action lawsuit in Western history. And important to recognize that that it was the outcome asked for by residential school survivors in their settlement agreement. So they won the court case against churches and government, saying that this was wrong behavior. But they were the ones who said, instead of just paying out as much as possible, we would like to set aside a significant chunk of funding that would go to a national initiative whereby Canadians could hear these stories and could know this truth, because we long for a future that would be different for our children and our grandchildren. And we long for healing in this country. And that can't come about until we have a shared understanding of our history. Mm. And so that was a 7-year process of hearings that happened across the country where residential school survivors were able to tell their stories, as well as former teachers and RCMP officers who were responsible to go catch children and return them to the schools when they ran away from home, or ran away from the schools rather. Those sorts of things. So that process is formally over, but there now is a National Center for Truth and Reconciliation, and that is in Winnipeg, and continues to document and hold these stories and find ways that we continue learning about them so that they aren't buried in our history and don't continue to bleed out in that wounding sense, right? And can actually be staunched and healed.
So do you think things are getting better for Indigenous people in their communities, or are we making any progress at all?
Yeah, and who's the we? It's an important question. Are Indigenous people making progress? Absolutely. Is there healing that is happening in communities? Absolutely. Does that have much to do with settlers? Non-Indigenous folks?
Jody, you've said settlers a couple times, and I just wonder, that's really an interesting term. Can you explain it to us?
Sure. So Indigenous means people of the land. So so there are people who were here, and then there are people who came later. And so we came at various stages. But the process actually of empires populating the world from a place of dominance. There were a variety of models for that, and the model for settling Canada, the US, Australia, and New Zealand was called settler colonialism. So the idea was you put the subjects of Britain in those places, and then you say, this belongs to us. And so that our presence here in various phases of immigration still serves the settler colonial purposes of laying claim to this land.
Okay, so you're saying there's two answers to that question, potentially. Are things getting better? Depends if you're a settler or if you're Indigenous.
Yeah, well, yes. And so let me quote Murray Sinclair, who is one of the commissioners for the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, said that he believed that Indigenous communities were on the path towards healing and greater strength within those communities. And the question is whether the church might be able to join them in that. Mm. So that was an interview done with the Mennonite magazine, particularly asking about these impacts for churches in particular.
That, I mean, to me, it sounds quite gracious asking the church to join them.
Yeah.
To be honest, like, why would they want that?
Why would they want that? That is an excellent question. And yet, that has always been the extension of it through this process. There's always been an extension of invitation from Indigenous peoples to settler folks in Canada.
Okay, well, Jody, can those of us who are not Indigenous, which makes us settlers, can we make a difference? And if so, how?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that is the stuff I spend weekends of workshops on. But in brief, there are steps that we can take towards making a difference. And I think humility is the first step, right? To recognize that that we are not the savior in this situation, but we long for healing together, and that we need to understand our place in that historical story, and that we've benefited as settlers from the very places where Indigenous people have lost, we have gained. But learning about this history, right, which has not been made available to many of us. So the information gap between kids who are in school right now and those of us who, are well past school, we didn't get the same information in school that kids are getting today.
Right.
So we've got some catching up to do, right? So learning about that. Some folks at in Kelowna have been a part of the Kairos Blanket exercise. When we get back to in-person things, that's a fantastic learning tool. But there are also things to be reading. So you've been reading Inconvenient Indian, is that right, Kevin?
Yes, yeah.
How has that impacted you?
Well, I haven't actually, I just started.
Okay.
But it's very disarming is what I'll say to begin with. And it's invited me in. So I found his writing style quite humble and disarming so far.
Totally.
Yeah.
So those kinds of learning, taking advantage of those is really key. I think two more things I would offer. One is that there are things that are built into our systems right now that we can have our hands removed from it, and it will continue to oppress Indigenous people. And so recognizing that that is true and that we need to get our hands in there to start dismantling the systems that will naturally continue to oppress because they are doing what they were set up to do. So holding government to account around some things like the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, which Trudeau came in and said, this is going to be our big thing, and it has yet to make it into a legislative framework. So that would be one area to work on. And the final one would be to make space for relationships. And again, in the midst of the pandemic, that's challenging. But probably there are people around you that when you start to pray and open your eyes, that you'll find things that you didn't expect.
So do you think, so this is a First Baptist Church podcast, and I'm just wondering if you would say that faith communities in general have a special role in this or more responsibility in being part of this or leading this and holding the government to account. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, because churches were the ones who enacted these government policies, I think both that reality gives us extra responsibility in being a part of dismantling the systems of oppression. And the other part of that is I don't have a ton of hope or expectation that government is going to set this right.
Right.
That's not where I put my hope for healing and restoration. I still believe that I have some civic duties in that respect.
Yeah, I was going to say, it feels like you see, Harper makes an apology, but it's like, what does it look like at the neighborhood and civic level, like for us to actually live that out?
Totally. So I'm going to give you an example of a church here in Vancouver. Not my church, so no worries there that they're saying self-promoting. But there's a church here that early on in the TRC process said Well, So we'd actually had the Vancouver Truth and Reconciliation events, and the pastor called me like a month later, and he said, "You know what? I need to apologize because my racism kept me from encouraging my congregation to be a part of that. Hmm. I'm afraid we've lost the opportunity to join this reconciliation journey. Hmm. Is that possible? Like, can we still get on board?" Right? An interesting question. And so we started to meet together with that church and their board of elders and ask, what might God be doing to call them into reconciliation? And they realized that they had this family that lived across the street from the church, and the mother every week dropped her kids off to Sunday school, and she never walked across the threshold of the church. He said, "Well, I think that might be the place to start. Hmm. Just go have a conversation with her and ask her why she won't come into the church." Hmm. So that was the beginning of a long journey that this church had in very practical ways with this neighbor, where they heard the story of her grandmother's experience with residential school, her sense that she needed to be honoring of her grandmother's memory by not crossing that threshold, but also her sense that there was something important happening for her kids in their experience.
Wow.
In Sunday school. And that church, as they came alongside of that woman and went to the hospital with her and experienced the racism that she experienced in hospital, as they intervened, as social services tried to take her kids out of her care and said, hey, like, what is it that you're feeling like is not in place here? Let us be family and help provide that. As they went to all of those places, they started to see the city and all of the systems from a very different perspective. And a couple of years into that process, this woman actually came to their service, and she came with a blanket and a coat. And she said, "I only have one blanket and one coat, but it's important to me in my tradition that when people have acted as family, for me to honor that and to make that explicit." And so she said, "So I'm gonna cover your pastor and his wife with my blanket and my coat."
Wow.
"As a sign that all of you are my family for the ways in which you have walked with us."
Wow, that's amazing.
Powerful.
Very powerful. Wow. So Jody, I'm excited to actually encourage our listeners to get their orange shirts and to wear their orange shirts on September 30th. I'm going to be wearing an orange shirt. I'm going to see if I can get one from the Friendship Center. And I really appreciate you telling us all about this and encouraging us to be part of the healing process. So thank you so much. And I actually have two questions that I'm asking my guests that are not quite related to this topic, but it depends on your answers, I suppose. But two questions, and the answers to these questions will be in show notes. Jody, if you had one book to recommend to us, what would it be?
It would be on this topic in some ways. And it would be a book called Braiding Sweetgrass. I have tons of books I would love to recommend, but the one, if I had to just do one, it would be Braiding Sweetgrass by Robin Wall Kimmerer. And it's just, it's beautifully done. She's an Indigenous woman who's a botanist, and she writes beautifully, and it's just her worldview and her work and her storytelling that come together in this really powerful, beautiful way.
So you liked it because it just invited you into the story?
It invited me into the story. It helped me see the world as she saw it, and it was beautiful, and it drew me into worship in new ways. Right?
Wow. Okay. That's a good one. Okay. So Braiding Sweetgrass. Mm-hmm. And the second question is, can you tell us maybe about a habit or a discipline that you have that has made your life better?
Yeah. I definitely have been like mining my habits and disciplines in the pandemic, right? Where it's like, yeah. Oh, which are the ones that are really important? And I found kind of a newer one for me, which has made a big difference. And it's breathing, which hopefully I have been doing for a long time, but yeah. breathing more intentionally, which I started doing for training for triathlon. And then I realized, oh, actually, this is super important for me just to make it through all of the unexpected anxieties of pandemic life.
So would you call that mindful breathing?
Mindful breathing, yep.
Is that like if you have an Apple Watch, you've got the Breathe app, you know, that sort of thing. So just pay attention to your breathing. And how long do you do that for?
I do it 3 days a week for 40 minutes.
Wow. Okay. This is extreme breathing.
It's extreme breathing. And some of it is like much more technical breathing that I'm learning to do, but like that as a prayer discipline, where I'm not creating the laundry list for God, but also just being present to the breath that is God's presence for me in the midst of actually learning how to breathe better.
Well, Jody, I want to thank you for being a guest and walking, being a catalyst for us in this.
Thanks so much, Kevin. I appreciate the invitation.
So, hey, thank you for listening. And I hope you feel better equipped to deal with life than you did before. And it's been great to talk about things that help us live better lives. And I look forward to connecting with you on our next podcast. So until next time, keep the faith and live in hope.
Thank you so much for listening. Please subscribe so that you can catch all our future episodes. You can search for us as FBC Perspective on iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.